Ghostbusters getting ghost, busting ghosts. Ghostbusters, the ghosts are getting busted tonight.
Well, hello there.
Welcome to He Saw, She Saw.
I am Corey.
And I am Keith.
And we love movies.
Just not the same ones.
So every episode we make the other one watch a movie that we love.
But the other would never watch unless we were doing a podcast.
And then we talk about it. We're going to attempt to record this, but the windows in our dining room are shaking violently. And you may hear it from time to time.
So regardless of the theme of the episode, it is not ghosts. Our place is not haunted.
Oh, if it is, I have to leave immediately.
But you may hear some windows rattling a little bit because we have some kids and it's summer break that live
upstairs.
Next to us.
And it's like wild animals.
Yeah.
So it makes our window shake.
And the kitchen studio that we're in. So.
So it's not ghosts.
So it's been a while since we've done an episode.
Yeah, it's been about 6 months. We meant to do episodes, but I don't know. The end of the year just kicked our butts, I feel like.
Yeah, we were very busy.
We were going to drop an episode during spring break. Spring break!
Spring break!
But we went on a family trip.
To New York City.
Woo! New York City, baby! And we had such a good time. I was a little nervous. I don't know why. I think it's because all my life I've always wanted to go to New York City. But New York City has always been kind of scary to me. And I guess I felt like a country mouse in the big city. And we went and we got pizza. We walked over to get some pizza, first thing. And then after we got the pizza, I kind of looked around and I was like, oh, okay, I get it. I know this is going to sound really stupid, but I did confirm this with two of our friends that we met up with who live there.
Shout out to Uncle Brandon and Uncle David.
Yes. It just kind of seems like downtown San Diego, but like 10 times bigger. And they both were like, yeah, that's what it is like. And so I have had that confirmed.
It was great. And we got to do most of the main things.
We couldn't find the Empire State Building. We saw it, but we couldn't find how to get in. And so we actually walked into the wrong entrance, but it was the right entrance. It's the entrance that Buddy uses when he goes in.
Yeah. So it's a beautiful, and we got a quick picture real quick. And the guards are looking at us like, you're not going to try to get in, are you? And we're like, no, we're just taking a picture.
We're taking a Buddy picture. And then we kept saying, my dad works here. Then we eventually found the correct entrance. We went to Central Park. Keith bought me the hottest flaming gyro. And I didn't know gyros could be hot, much less the third ring of hell hot. We were like, hey, let's have street vendor food. Keith brings it over to me and I dive in because I'm absolutely starving. And my mouth feels like it's on fire. It was so hot that I was like seeing spots.
You grabbed me by the collar and said, look at me. You are going to get me a blue Gatorade right now. And I did. I normally don't like very much spice at all. At some point, Corey decided she doesn't either. Although I always remember getting her at least a little bit of spice. And she was always having to calm it down a little bit for my palate. So when the vendor said, hey, do you want some hot sauce on it? I was like, well, yeah, it's for my beautiful wife who likes things hotter than me. So I said, yes. He put the same hot sauce on my kebab. On the gyro, it was like 20 times hotter than it was on the kebab. So I don't know how that works.
I have never had something so hot that it made me see spots. I was seeing spots.
But we went to
Times Square Target.
Yeah. And we also had dinner at Macy's, overseeing the Empire State Building from the window.
They gave us a nice window table. Everybody was so nice. I was so surprised. I thought everyone was going to be mean to us, but everybody was really nice.
And the other thing that was really cool about our trip was getting to go to the Statue of Liberty and getting to go inside. And
we went inside the crown.
Yeah. And you heard from everybody, the Statue of Liberty is only as thick as 2 pennies. And you're like, that doesn't make sense. And then you're in there. I may or may not have knocked from the inside on the Statue of Liberty. And it was a hollow bell sound. So it was like, oh yeah, that is only 2 pennies thick.
I got a picture of the inside of her face.
I know. That was a great picture.
Thank you. We braved the subway. Keith had been talking about, oh my gosh, the Ghostbusters firehouse is here. We need to go see the Ghostbusters firehouse.
Because it's free.
And I didn't know quite where it was. We had to like navigate the subway to get there. But we made it. So I know we were going to do another thing for our episode. However, being in New York inspired us because we're at all these places that things were filmed at. Mm-hmm. And we were at the Ghostbusters firehouse. So mm-hmm. I was like, why don't we do an episode where we watch Ghostbusters? Because I was never allowed to watch Ghostbusters. I have never seen Ghostbusters.
Which was absolutely shocking to me.
We're going to watch.
Don't tell her mom.
We're going to watch Ghostbusters.
And then the best movie to pair with Ghostbusters would be
Lady Ghostbusters.
Lady Ghostbusters.
Which
so
I did see.
And I did not.
It's got all my girls in it.
Yeah.
What's that sigh of?
Oh, we'll see.
All right. So we've paired Gentleman Ghostbusters with Lady Ghostbusters.
Who are you going to call?
Lady Ghostbusters. So, Keith,
mm-hmm.
did Ghostbusters from 1984 hold up for you?
Wasn't the movie I totally remember. Now, again, I saw it basically when it came out. The thing is that Ghostbusters was like the epitome of cool when it came out. And time kind of changes. So, it's a funny movie that it's a product of its time. It's good, but it's not amazing anymore. So it's kind of slow paced. Three quarters of it is Bill Murray trying to get laid with anything that has a pulse. So that part doesn't age very well. And the special effects also are very, at best, Jason and the Argonauts. So, but it's just a fun movie.
Yeah, I remember because I was in second grade. All the cool boys had like the Ghostbusters shirt. And for a while, I did not know what that meant or what that was. So, do you want to hear my pitch?
I would love to hear your pitch. And could you please put the movie title at the last word, please?
Maybe.
Okay.
All right. When a group of paranormal experts lose their funding, they strike out on their own during a rising supernatural threat of apocalyptic proportions to single-handedly save New York City as the Ghostbusters.
Yes, you finally did it.
Yeah, I feel cheap.
What?
Sold out.
Oh, come on.
So we open at the New York Public Library, which we drove past and took pictures of.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, when we were there, of course, the day that we did the open top bus sightseeing tour, it poured. It cleared up. So we see one of my favorite tertiary character actors, Alice Drummond. She's been in Two Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar, and Ace Ventura, and of course, my favorite, she was in Funny Farm, which, have you seen Funny Farm?
Mm-mm.
Oh, we need to see Funny Farm. That's a good movie. I have a list right now,
mm-hmm.
making a list. So I'm going to call her Alice because she doesn't have a name.
Mm-hmm.
Alice is a librarian, and she's walking through the stacks, and all of a sudden, books start levitating behind her. And then the card catalog drawers open on their own, and the cards start shooting out all over the room. And all I could think of was how long it would take to put all those cards back into order.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember using the card catalog when you were in elementary school?
Oh, yeah. For people who are not familiar, you have to have a card per book.
Per book.
And libraries have tens of thousands of books.
Mm-hmm.
To take a drawer which has like hundreds of cards and just throw them up in the air, it hurt me.
Oh, okay. So it's not just me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So anyway, Alice is spooked. Mm-hmm. And she starts running down an aisle where all of a sudden she starts screaming in horror as she encounters a horrifying spirit of mm-hmm. some sort. We don't know because we don't see it. So cut to Columbia University. However, Columbia wished that they not be named. When I did my research, actually, I have never had so much fun going down the rabbit hole of research that I did. Anyways, Dr. Peter Venkman, who is Bill Murray, so he's running this parapsychological test on two students, but really, he's just using it as an excuse to hit on Gwendolyn from Charles in Charge.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever watch Charles in Charge?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, do you remember Gwendolyn?
Vaguely.
Okay. So he keeps using electroshock on the male subject until the male subject gets fed up and storms out. Venkman is about to go in for the kill.
To be with the woman.
To know the woman. When they are interrupted by his very excited colleague, Ray Stantz, played by Dan Aykroyd, who just is a delight.
Mm-hmm.
Like a little puppy. So he has just been contacted by the New York Public Library about a supernatural phenomenon. So Venkman, begrudgingly, follows Stantz to the library, where they meet up with Egon Spengler, who is Harold Ramis. He is described in the script as New Wave Spock. And that is about what I would
say. That's what you got.
So Spangler tells them that they've got something really big here, and Venkman says this reminds him of the time that he tried to drill a hole through his head, to which Spangler responds.
And that would have worked if you hadn't stopped me.
Which I found both disturbing and intriguing, and I wanted to know more, but we just kind of brushed right past that.
Yeah, ancient Mayans, I think, used to do that, and I think Greeks might have as well. So it's something that...
So Venkman takes the lead on questioning poor Alice, and she's lying on a table being treated for shock. He's just checking to see if there's any psychosis in her family, whether she does drugs, and if she's menstruating, which I took umbrage with. I mean, am I homicidal during my periods? Yes. But don't you dare call me crazy.
Venkman doesn't appear to believe in any of this.
I know.
Mean, from that first scene, it's like, look, he just wants to have as much sex as possible with young 20-year-olds. He's the person who's like, look, I don't believe this stuff.
Yeah.
But he kind of goes with the flow.
I did notice that. So the boys head to the stacks to check things out. Spangler and Stance are giddy, but as you said, Venkman is a bit bored and petulant because he was interrupted with his pursuit of a young lass. So they notice a pile of books stacked vertically, and Spangler is fascinated, but Venkman says...
That's true. No man would ever stack books like this.
No human being would stack books like this.
Mm-hmm.
So they encounter a presence, which is an old woman who's reading a book, and they make Venkman talk to it. And when he does, it shushes him. So Stance comes with a genius plan, and they rush the ghost. And this backfires when the elderly lady turns into a demon and roars at them, which apparently she roared quiet, but I didn't catch that. So they're so scared that they run screaming from the building, and the head librarian is running after them, and he asks, what was it? And Venkman yells back, we'll get back to you. So upon their return to the university, they find that the dean is in their office, and he's supervising a group of men who are moving their equipment out. The dean happily announces that the university will no longer be honoring their grant. Stance is devastated, but Venkman sees this as an opportunity to go into business for themselves. And Stance balks a little bit, and he asks, well, where are we going to get the money? Cut to the boys exiting a bank, having taken out an additional mortgage on Stan's inherited childhood home at
19%.
Which is like, what, triple what it is now?
It's a high mortgage rate no matter what time. It's his third mortgage on the home, so it's not the first time he's done this.
Right.
Yeah, clearly is a bad deal. So
a predatory loan.
Yeah.
So they end up buying an old rundown firehouse, which has a lot of problems, but they buy it because Stance likes the fireman's pole. Isn't this place great?
You guys got to try this.
We should stay over tonight. So we then meet Dana Barrett, who is played by Sigourney Weaver, who, according to the script, is a cellist in her late 20s. She gets out of a cab, and she carries her groceries up to her apartment on Central Park West, which we walked past. It was the site of the Euro from hell.
Mm-hmm.
She's stopped by her neighbor, Louis Tully, who is played by Rick Moranis, in all his strange brew glory, who falls all over himself trying to impress her with his vitamin regimen and assortment of healthy mineral waters.
Yeah, and he's wearing a sweatsuit. He, high water sweatsuit.
He's really
but...
going for it.
Mm-hmm.
And trainers and...
Mm-hmm.
So he invites her to a party that he's having for his accounting clients, even though he knows that she does her own taxes.
Well, she really shouldn't.
She says she'll try to make it. And then she slips into her apartment, cutting him off, but not before Tully warns her to keep her TV volume down when she's out. Because the creep down the hall called and told on her about it. And she's like, well, that's funny. I didn't think I left the TV on, but the TV's on. So she walks into her apartment, and a commercial for the Ghostbusters is playing. And it is the most amateurish commercial I've ever seen. One person talks, so they step in, and then they step out. The other person talks and steps in and steps out. And their slogan, do you remember what their slogan is?
Ghostbusters, we're ready to believe you.
Yeah, very good. As Dana puts her groceries away, the eggs start popping out of the carton and fry themselves on the counter. And she's a little freaked out, and then she hears some noise and growling coming from her refrigerator, at which point I would be like, no thank you, and I would move away. But she goes ahead and opens the refrigerator door.
She's a white woman in a horror movie. Of course she's moving towards whatever the horrible thing that's about to kill her.
So So when she opens the door, it's kind of like a portal to some other dimension. There's like this temple and light coming out of it. And there's these things that at first they look like dragons. They have red eyes and they growl. And we hear the name Zool, and then she slams the door. Mm-hmm. And then I think she leaves for a few days, she says later. Nope, I'd be, bye. So meanwhile, the Ghostbusters have fixed the firehouse up pretty nicely.
Yeah, miraculously.
Like, really nice.
Yeah.
In a few days, Stance pulls up in an old-fashioned ambulance.
Isn't it a Hertz?
So I looked it up.
Okay.
They bought this car, the filmmakers. It was a hearse that they turned into an ambulance that they turned into a hearse or something.
Oh, wow.
So it looks like both a hearse and an ambulance. So it just needs a little work. Suspension, shocks, brakes, brake pads, lining, steering box, transmission, rear end, maybe new rings, also a muffler, a little wiring. But everyone can relax because I found a car. We also meet Janine, who is played by Annie Potts, and she is the new receptionist, who is impervious to Venkman's charms. But she is fully into Egon.
He's such a humanitarian. Good head of hair.
You really good head of hair.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Dana Barrett enters, and she asks to speak to someone. And it's hilarious. Venkman literally falls all over himself, and he hops out of his office and vaults over furniture just to get next to her. So cut to Dana is hooked up to, I guess it was a lie detector test, and she's recounting her experiences to the boys. And they determine that she is telling the truth, or at least she thinks she's telling the truth. So Venkman volunteers to take Dana to her apartment and check her out. I mean, check it out.
Check the apartment out.
While the others research her building to see if there's anything weird about it, and they want to find out who Zool is. So Dana takes Venkman back to her place, and he shows himself around, including the bedroom, to which Dana says, nothing ever happened in there. And he says,
what a shame.
What a crime.
What a crime.
Dana tells him he doesn't act like a scientist. He acts like a game show host.
That's generous.
They check out the kitchen, and to Dana's disappointment, everything's normal. Venkman tells her he doesn't think she's crazy, to which she says,
how reassuring.
Oh, good. That makes me feel so much better.
Yeah.
So the final straw is when Venkman proclaims his love to her, and she kicks him out.
Yeah, gentlemen, that's a good move.
Just go at it.
Yeah.
I'm gonna go for broke here.
When she shows no interest whatsoever.
You should do that. Meanwhile, the boys get a boost when a hotel calls about a supernatural disturbance, but they want it handled discreetly. So they, of course, pull up with their siren blaring, which I thought sounded odd, and it's because it's actually a leopard snarl played backwards.
Really?
Yeah, that's why it sounds so weird.
Wow, okay.
So the siren's blaring, they're in matching jumpsuits with all kinds of blinking gadgets attached to them, and a guest asks them if they're cosmonauts, and Venkman assures him that they're just the exterminators. So Stance laments that they didn't get a chance to test any of their equipment, but Venkman's like, eh, why worry? I mean, we only have unlicensed nuclear accelerators on our backs. So after they accidentally zap the maid in her cart.
Thankfully, they don't hit the maid.
No, they don't hit the maid. But they do hit the cart and do some damage to the walls of the hotel. They split up because, as Venkman says, oh, good.
We can do more damage that way.
So they separately encounter a slimy green specter who likes to chow down on room service scraps. And they chase him all over the hotel, causing all kinds of destruction. And they end up in a ballroom, destroying the chandelier and knocking over tables. I think we should have a segment where we rate my anxiety level over the destruction that someone is causing.
Oh, yeah.
And the inevitable cleanup. I can't handle it. So right before they trap Slimer, Spangler remembers to tell them, oh, don't cross the streams or else like life as we know it is going to cease to exist. You know, so bad.
And it's weird because when they shoot out the lasers or whatever, it's not straight.
It's
like, how could you ever control how it shoots out? Like, that's kind of the whole point. So,
but they work together, and without crossing their streams, they catch the ghost in their homemade trap. So the Ghostbusters completely take off after that. And we get a news montage of their rising success. And Dana's kind of following it. And they begin working so much that they have to hire another worker, Winston Zeddemore, to help carry the load. And they get a visit from Walter Peck from the EPA. And he wants to inspect their equipment. But Venkman turns him away. And he threatens to come back with a court order. In the meantime, Venkman makes a date with Dana to discuss his findings of Zool, who I guess is a Sumerian demigod who was a servant of Gozer, who's a shape-shifting god of destruction. Good times. So Spangler's getting worried that something big is about to happen supernaturally. And plus, their little ghost jail storage is almost full. And meanwhile, on top of Dana's building, we see it a couple times. It's like, it's totally superimposed. It's like a temple and there's like these gargoyles. And so the gargoyles come to life. So we cut to Dana's trying to sneak past Louis Tully's party. It's in full swing. And guys, there's salmon that he got. You guys, that's Nova Scotia salmon. I got it for $14.99. It was originally $24. Mm-hmm. So he's having this party for his client so he can write it off. And so he's like listing all of the prices of everything that they're enjoying. Mm-hmm. So she says, oh, I have a date, but you know, we'll try to stop by. So as she gets ready for her date, one of the reanimated gargoyle puppies grab her. Meanwhile, Lewis's little party is ruined when the other gargoyle puppy chases him out of the building and through Central Park. And ultimately, he possesses him, and then he's wandering around asking everyone if they're the gatekeeper because he's the keymaster. So Venkman shows up at Dana's. He's ready for their date, and she answers the door and asks if he's the keymaster because she is the gatekeeper. And she's had a full possession makeover, and she's wearing a robe of some sort, like a Grecian.
There's a lot of orange sequins.
Yes, like lame, a lot of blush. Mm-hmm. And she, her hair is perpetually blowing, so that's how you know she's possessed. So she tries to seduce Venkman, and I'm actually very proud of him because he doesn't take advantage of that.
That's one of my favorite jokes in the movie, is she opens up the door and is like totally possessed and is like, are you the key master? And he says no, and she slams the door. And then he waits a second, knocks on the door, and she opens it up and says, are you the key master? And he says, yes.
But he doesn't do anything because, and he's actually pretty disappointed. So Venkman has some good in him.
Yeah, he takes her possession very calmly and he does. Knows what to do. And
you know, she's like, hey, I want you. And he's like, yeah, but there's priority two people at least in there. And that's kind of
crowded, yeah.
He tries to speak to Dana with no luck. And he ends up giving her a lot of Thorazine, which I was like, demons are affected by Thorazine?
Well, if they're possessing the body and the body starts to break down, then there's still, can't. Yeah.
I don't know about that, Keith.
Wow, okay.
So cut to Stance and Zeddemore, and they're quoting Revelations and wondering if these are, in fact, the last days. So back at the firehouse, the police drop off Louis Tully, who seems to be more of a Ghostbuster problem. So they take him in and they do some tests with the colander and the heat sensing, whatever.
On the heat sensing thing, it's not Louis's face.
Right.
It's the face of the gargoyle.
I think we both noticed it at the same time. Mm-hmm. So he says he's waiting for a sign that Gozer has returned. So after a phone call with Venkman, they realize that they have the gatekeeper and a keymaster on their hands, whatever that means. And they decide to keep the pair separated.
Oh, I thought they said they need to get those two together.
Well, Venkman says, hey, you think we should get these two together? And then they realize, no, we should not.
Okay.
Yeah, because they're the ingredient for the apocalypse. So Venkman's going to stay with Dana, and the others should not let Tully out of their sight no matter what. So the next day, dun dun dun, Peck shows up with the EPA. He's got cops with him and like a city worker, and he demands that the ghost storage be shut off. And the Ghostbusters warn that shutting it down could be catastrophic, but Peck doesn't care, and he bullies the poor city worker to shut it down. And there's this huge explosion, and all the trapped ghosts escape out into the city. And one flies out of a street vendor's cart, and I said, oh, look, there's that Euro from hell. Mm-hmm. So Louis wanders off during this kerfuffle, and he heads towards his apartment building. And the boys are put in jail. While in jail, I don't know how they were able to have maps and schematics and paperwork and such, but they have like all their maps and schematics and paperwork, and they're having this really tense conversation, and all the prisoners are just listening, like with bated breath.
Yeah, it's like the old Brian Reagan skit where you're like watching Nova or something like that, and you've got like potato chips, and you're like, oh yeah, they didn't think of gravity.
You gotta incorporate gravity.
Uh-huh, yeah. So all these prisoners are helping with that.
So yes, they have rapt attention from the other prisoners. They figure out that Dana and Lewis's building at 55 Central Park West, which we drove past, is actually built as an antenna for the supernatural and is going to be used to summon Gozer to bring about the apocalypse. So Carl Winslow, Reginald Bell Johnson.
From Family Matters.
From Family Matters.
And also the cop from Die Hard.
Plays the cop again. Actually, did you know that he was considered to play Zedmore?
Aww.
Yeah.
So he would have been great.
I know. So they give him the cop part when he didn't get it.
Mm.
So he lets them know that the mayor is busting them out because he needs their help. To the chagrin of Peck, who caused this whole mess in the first place, but the city is literally overrun with ghosts and supernatural activity, and Peck is removed from the meeting, and the mayor asks the boys if they need anything. So Dana wakes up at a certain point and blasts a hole into her apartment, and Lewis finds her, and they head up to the roof to the temple altar that is on top of there. They both turn into gargoyle puppies.
They may or may not be making love. We're not sure.
Ew!
Because they have the whole moment, like they see each other, and then Sigourney Weaver dips him with a huge big kiss, and you're like, okay, Keymaster, Gatekeeper. Okay. Yeah.
They turn into gargoyle puppies. Oh, and the gargoyle puppies, I think we both laughed at that point because it was like so claymation.
Oh, yeah. Anytime the gargoyle puppies are around, you're just like, oh my gosh.
So Gozer appears as a lanky model, and the boys try to zap her, and she disappears. And then she threatens them to choose the form of the Destructor. And Venkman urges them all to just empty their minds. But Stans, being the little puppy that he is, mm-hmm. accidentally thinks of the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man from his childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so Marshmallow Man comes stomping down the city streets. They train their lasers on him, and after they set him into a flaming marshmallow of destruction, did you know that there were 18 suits made at $20,000 a pop? And
oh my
17
gosh.
Of them were completely incinerated.
Oh my gosh.
Egon decides that they should cross streams at the gate. And so they do this, and this destroys the Marshmallow Man and closes the gate to the other dimension. And so there's this white marshmallow explosion. So they used 75 pounds of shaving cream. Mm-hmm. At first they were going to use 125 pounds. But the guy who plays Peck was like, wait a minute, we should test this out. And it knocked people over, so they decided to use 75 pounds. And after a long day of filming, everybody got a rash. So Dana and Lewis's gargoyle puppies turn back to concrete. And Venkman is really sad because he thinks that they all think Dana is dead. Oh, and mm-hmm. Lewis too. Until they realize that Dana and Lewis are actually still alive inside. And so they break them out of the concrete. And they walk out onto the street to a city full of adoring fans. And that is the end of the movie. So, a little bit trivia for you.
Okay.
The people who were considered for Venkman are the following. Michael Keaton, Chevy Chase, Tom Hanks, Robin Williams,
mm-hmm.
Steve Guttenberg, and Richard Pryor.
Wow.
Yes. I think Bill Murray is, I hate to say it, but I think he's kind of a pain in the butt. Because he doesn't commit to things until, like he makes everybody sweat and then he'll, like, commit to something.
Mm.
So, they were afraid that that was going to happen. So, yeah, they had all these people, like, in the chamber.
Each of them would be kind of different.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, of course, given that list, I'm always going to go to Robin Williams.
I don't know. I think he would just be too over the top.
He would have had to...
Tone it down,
which yeah. I think would have been interesting. Because later on in his career, he tones it down several times. So.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So then the people who were considered for Spengler were Christopher Walken.
Wow.
John Lithgow.
Uh-huh.
Christopher Lloyd. And Jeff Goldblum. Jeff Goldblum would be my favorite in that scenario.
Yeah, but it'd be...
He'd be way too...
Ladies, man.
Yeah. There's no way Jeff Goldblum could be clueless with the ladies.
That would have made Annie Potts make much more sense for her to be completely swooning over him.
Mm-hmm. Although, Harold Ramis is a handsome man. They were hesitant to cast Sigourney Weaver because she had done such serious stuff up until then. However, at her audition, she was crawling around on all fours and howling. So they were like, all right.
I will do it.
Gozer was actually supposed to be played by Paul Reubens. Pee-wee Herman.
Gozer?
Yeah. But no. He passed on it. So then they changed it to a woman.
I'm bummed Reubens said no to it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was thinking that there's only one name, David Bowie, for that part.
Well, the thing is, when she popped up, I was like, oh, she is so David Bowie. And mm-hmm. she was actually modeled after Grace Jones and David Bowie's, like, androgynousness.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, you are right.
Yeah.
But, yeah, David Bowie would have been perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he would have done it, though. I don't know. He did do... When was the grooming movie?
I don't know if there's a role or a person he wouldn't do. So, I'm a little surprised he wasn't approached for it.
Okay, here's something interesting. Did you know that Dan Aykroyd's father wrote a book called The History of Ghosts.
No,
I didn't know that. And his great-grandfather was like a ghost chaser.
Really?
Yeah. So that's why he wrote it. Uh-huh. He and Harold Ramis wrote it. That's why this story exists.
Yeah.
It was originally going to be kind of more like a supernatural, like the whole thing was going to be set in the supernatural realm, but they decided it was going to be too expensive. Mm-hmm. So they had Harold Ramis come on to make it kind of more grounded and realistic to mm-hmm. make the supernatural stuff more ridiculous and to set it in New York City.
Yeah.
So this was the first comedy to use expensive special effects ever.
Really?
Yes. And it is one of the most successful comedies of the 1980s. And in 2015, the Library of Congress selected it for preservation in the National Film Registry. I don't know why that chokes me up, but it does.
That would
so stupid.
That would be cool to make something that would be so important that they would say, no, we're going to preserve this forever.
So I listen to a lot of true crime stuff. And whenever something happens in New York City in the 70s or 80s, they spend 5 minutes telling us how, like, New York City was a dump in the 80s and just mm-hmm. really, like, dangerous. And so Ghostbusters, along with a Saturday Night Fever, have been credited with recovering the negative perception of New York City in the 80s. Reitman wanted to set it in New York City, and he wanted this to be his New York movie.
It's a testament to art being powerful for an artist to say, this is not what New York City is now, but this is what it could be. Yeah. And then to watch it turn into what you want it to be.
Life,
that's pretty cool.
Art.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as I have said a bunch of times, the building was actually at 55 Central Park West. And so at one point when they were filming, they had to close down the two streets, and it was during rush hour, and everybody was so upset. And so they were like, ah, it's Francis Ford Coppola. He's making a movie. Like, to not him. And then the one funny thing was, I guess, I don't know if Isaac Asimov, like, lived in the building, but somehow he had an interaction with Dan Aykroyd where he was complaining, you know, you shouldn't be able to disrupt this whole building. And Dan Aykroyd's just like, ugh! Mm-hmm. Isaac Asimov's yelling at me. So when we decided we were going to do Ghostbusters, I happened to come across this article on the giantfreakinrobot.com about how Bill Murray forever changed the English language. Because he improvised a line right before they zap Gozer. He says, this chick is toast. So he turned toast into an idiom that is still used to refer to someone or something that is doomed. So before you would say, you would have like someone turn into toast or serve them on toast. Mm-hmm. And so he said, this chick is toast. And no one had ever done that before, apparently. And actually, the Oxford Dictionary acknowledges Bill Murray's contribution to the English language.
Good for Bill Murray.
So if you want to read the article, I will post it in our socials and you can read it. Okay, so that's all the trivia I have for you. Sorry. I spent so much time just like going down all the rabbit holes of all the cool, interesting facts. Do you want to know how I felt about this movie?
Yeah.
Well, you know I love Bill Murray. Mm-hmm. So like anything he does, I will watch. I think that he's an improv genius. And I can tell that he vamped a lot in the film. And actually, I did find out that Ivan Reitman kept to the script, but he also let them improvise. I adore Dan Aykroyd, and I loved the relationship between the three of them. Because you've got Venkman's like the mouth, Stance is the heart,
Egon's
like the head, the brain. Mm-hmm. I read an article where they said that they're the lion, the tin man, and the scarecrow. I'm so smart that I got that. Every song in the movie, like that wasn't an instrumental song, was very like, oh, they're ghosts and they're gonna do this thing. Like they.
Mm-hmm. Or we're gonna save the day.
The songs were basically written for the movie. I thought that the writing was really clever and snappy and funny. So yeah, I'm gonna give it 2 thumbs up because it was fun. And I enjoyed, you know, when you watch a movie and it's fun. So you like look, you try to watch all of the extra features, like the gag reels, the trivia, and watch it again and listen to the commentary or whatever. It was like that type of movie for me. I ain't afraid of no ghosts. Actually, I really am. Please don't haunt me. I will run away.
Two Ghostbuster movies.
Yes.
Woo!
Ladies and gentlemen.
We've done the original, and now we're going to do Lady Ghostbusters, which they would probably hate that name of it. Uh-huh. We're going to do Ghostbusters Answer the Call. But the question I need to start with is, how did this movie hold up for you?
Well, it came out in 2016, so really hasn't had, well, how many years is that? Like 6? 5? 25?
Like 7.
So, I mean, it's not that old. I was actually surprised that it was as far back as it was.
I blame the plague. Like, my sense of time has completely gone out of the window.
Well, we lost like 2 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got my heavy hitters. It's got, you know, Melissa McCarthy, who is one of my favorites, and I don't know if we've told this story, but we got to see her perform at the Groundlings. I was taking classes at the Groundlings in Hollywood, and we decided after class one day we should see a show. Mm-hmm. And so you had come with me, sitting there waiting for my three-hour class to be over. And so then afterwards we went to a show, and she was in the show, and it was, I think she was doing Gilmore Girls, but she hadn't really taken off yet, and she was absolutely just ridiculously funny, like, make you pee your pants laugh.
Yeah, they did like a sketch show. It was like seven sketches, and she was like the featured player in like five of them.
Well, and just all her characters are super awkward, so, and she even kind of came into the audience at one point, and she threw toilet paper at us.
And we should have caught
the toilet paper.
I could, if I reached over the people in front of us, I could. I had a bean for it, but it kind of went to them, so I didn't force my way.
It was crazy because we didn't really know who she was. And then all of a sudden, we were like, whoa.
I don't know if I've ever met anybody who can do so many different types of awkward as Melissa McCarthy. Because like, it's not the same character every time, but it's awkward. But it's different types of awkward.
Yeah, it's very nuanced. Mm-hmm. Each different character. But anyway, went on a rabbit hole there. So she will always forever be my favorite. Of course, Kate McKinnon is just, I hope to one day be like Kate McKinnon. She's ridiculous and I love her. Kristen Wiig, come on. And Leslie Jones has always been one of my favorite.
I love Leslie Jones. Yeah. She is awesome.
Like when she did that sketch where they were in the Ghost Hunters, like, and she was like, no!
Oh, yeah.
I have always loved her. She's like the female Tracy Morgan.
Yeah.
So just like all my favorite ladies together, like having a blast. You're probably going to mention this later, but all the cameos that pop up. It was great. So it's even more fun because it's like sanctioned by everybody and everybody's having a good time. So now and then, which Hemsworth is it?
Chris.
Thor, right?
Yeah, Thor.
I thought it was funny that what's the opposite of misogyny?
Oh, yeah.
They just, like, you guys have had a good run. We're going to go for your jugular now.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the reasons I didn't want to see this movie was that I knew some people were clearly being just very misogynist. Mm. However,
like there can be no lady Ghostbusters.
Yeah, and just making stupid comments. All the press sources I was getting was that Chris Hemsworth is the only thing in this movie worth watching, and from a lot of critics.
I feel like he's the frosting on the cake, and I think they even refer to him as such.
I think that might be a little Freudian, but
frosting on the very well-made cake, and don't make it Freudian.
Yeah, no, you already got there.
He's the fondant on an already well flavored.
It happened. I'm okay with it.
I can't.
It's okay.
You made it weird.
He's a very handsome man.
He's all right. Do you have a pitch for this movie?
I do. When someone starts breaking down the walls between our world and the next, it is up to four new Ghostbusters to answer the call. So we open at a place called the Aldridge Mansion, where a tour guide is trying his best to spook a group of tourists on how the place is haunted by the rich owner's daughter, who had gone on a big murderous spree, and then they had locked her in the dungeon.
It was very Lizzie Borden.
Yeah. However, that night, after he's locking up, we find out the mansion truly is haunted, as the murderous daughter's ghost traps him in the basement and appears to kill him or maim him or something. And that leads us to the opening credits. And after that, we meet Erin Gilbert, who's played by Kristen Wiig, who is getting ready to do her first science lecture at Columbia University. And she's trying to psych herself up, and then she's scared by Ed Begley Jr., who's behind her.
Science or like math?
We find out it's science.
Oh.
There's a lot of math on the board behind her.
Got it.
The science that they practice is physics. And I never took physics, so.
I just went into a math coma, so I couldn't.
Yeah, it was a lot of calculus. Well, and they also made a message out of the math. Some of the math was real. And then some of the math, if you typed it into your Google machine, it would take you to a special marketing website that they took down like after the year.
But
he scares her because he needs to talk to her about something she wrote, and she's like, what publication, because clearly she's a young academic.
It's
impossible to become a full-time professor anywhere. She is very surprised when he said the book Ghosts of Our Past, which immediately makes her turtle. If she had had a shell, she would have climbed into it. And she's mortified.
She climbed into her turtleneck.
And she disowns it. And she's and does everything she can. Because she's clearly trying to become a real professor at a real university. The man keeps pressing since he owns the Aldred Mansion. which has a ghost problem, and the police think he's crazy. So Erin still doesn't say yes, but wonders where he got the books, since she distinctly remembers burning both copies of it. He is confused because it's on Amazon as a hardcover, ebook, and audiobook. But
I got the book because I know how to read.
Exactly. Desperate to keep her chance at tenure, she makes a beeline to the much less prestigious Kenneth P. Higgins Institute of Science, which looks like someone's making a lot of money off of government grants because
it's like
they're horrible.
It's like the school that Chip Baskett's brother runs in Baskets.
Yeah, so she tracks down her old friend, Abby Yates, who is played by Megan McCarthy.
And
she,
Melissa McCarthy.
Which is played by Melissa McCarthy.
You gotta get the names right, Keith. I know names aren't your friend.
They aren't. So, Abby has a crazy scattered lab with a similarly crazy scattered assistant, Jillian Holtzman, who's played by Kate McKinnon. Abby refuses to take down the books, and so it's a real revenue stream for her. She's so far earned 1/10 of a mini fridge. However, she relents when Erin mentions the Aldred Mansion has contacted her about a ghost. If Erin introduces Abby to the people at the mansion, then she'll take down the book until Erin gets her stupid tenure at Columbia. They head over to the mansion, and disappointingly, the tour guide is there, which I think is
He's across the street, though.
Yeah, there's two big mistakes in this movie. One of which is that he wasn't horribly maimed or killed or disappeared or something.
He soiled his pants,
Keith. But the joke, but what I loved about the initial tone was ghosts are scary.
Mm-hmm.
One of my problems with the first movie is there's no real danger for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, it was like, you don't have to maim him. But we shouldn't see him again.
Yeah,
like
he should be
disappeared, or he quit and never will come back. They go into the mansion and they find slime, parts of a machine, and a class 4 apparition, which is a ghost. So the spirit is beautiful at first. It's the rich guy's daughter, but completely slimes Erin and flies out of the mansion. They're ecstatic because they've seen a ghost, and ghosts are real. And they have it on film. The footage does get uploaded to the internet. Unfortunately, Erin is immediately fired from getting tenure at Columbia University, goes over to complain to Abby and Jillian, and then Abby and Jillian are fired from their jobs because the dean, who doesn't look like a dean, doesn't act like a dean, and is only a dean because the last dean got thrown in jail, didn't realize the apartment still existed. They haul out of there with a whole bunch of machinery, not theirs, but they kind of make it okay for them to steal it because the dean yells at them, what are you doing with all that worthless machinery that belongs to the university? So sure, they stole it, but it's like junk.
It's
so,
homemade.
Yeah. We then get to meet our fourth lead, Leslie Jones, who plays a woman named Patty, who works at the help desk at the subway, not the sandwich shop, but the actual New York subway. This creepy guy walks up to the window and thanks Patty for doing a thankless job. And when the apocalypse comes, she will be the last to be killed. Patty just kind of rolls her eyes and he goes ahead and walks through the gate and then walks up to the subway platform and walks off the subway platform and starts walking down the tunnel. So that means Patty's got to go follow him. So he goes.
No, thank you.
Yeah. So Patty starts to follow him. And he's so far up ahead, he plants this blue electronic device. It kind of is like a hubcap size. And it explodes, and then it summons a ghost. And this ghost scares and chases Patty out of the tunnel. We cut back to our newly fired but future Ghostbusters, who are in the only place they can afford a couple small rooms on top of a Chinese restaurant, which keeps screwing up Abby's orders. They're setting up shop, and they need a receptionist, which enters Chris Hemsworth, who plays Kevin, who is just ridiculously handsome and brawny. And he's a wannabe actor who is as dim-witted as he is hunky. He is just horribly unqualified, and Erin is absolutely infatuated to the point of committing minor sexual harassment but not being able to stop herself. But he's the only applicant, and so he gets the job. And they have a hilarious interview, which is actually improv. Chris Hemsworth comes up with the idea of having a dog named Mike Hat, but he says it so quick, it always sounds like my cat.
Can you bring my cat?
And he also improvises an aquarium is a submarine for goldfish, and they tell him, like, okay, can you go stand over here and not listen? He's like, oh, okay. And he puts his fingers over his eyes instead of his ears. coup de grace is he hits the gong and it makes this horrible sound and he immediately covers his eyes. He is a gem in this movie. He is amazing. And he also gets a job. So they also have Patty, who's just waiting in the hallway at the top of the stairs because she thought that was the reception area because there was a magazine nearby. She comes in and wants to talk about this ghost that she saw. So they head down to the MTA with ghost finding devices and a rolling proton pack that's about as big as a washer dryer.
I don't know how they got it down on the tracks.
Yeah. So they find the remains of the device. And also the ghost is still there. The proton pack is able to slow down the ghost, but can't capture the ghost. The creepy guy, who we find out his name is Rowan, he's in the basement of some hotel that he works at, and he's creating these like hubcap devices and that are opening doors for ghosts, essentially. And he says, charge the lines, create the vortex, break the barrier. We then have quite a bit of exposition. Patty officially joins the team. She's like a walking encyclopedia of New York City. I like that they gave a reason for her to join the team instead of just like, oh, you're hired. And also, her uncle lets them borrow a car, which is, of course, a Hertz.
Because he owns a funeral parlor.
Exactly.
In Jersey.
Not an enterprise rent-a-car. That's what he had.
Is there a body back there? I don't know. Check.
I can think of 7 good uses of a cadaver today. That's a Kate McKinnon line if you didn't realize. But yes, so we get uniforms, we get proton packs which fit on their backs, and we see that they're starting to get fame online. We have this debunker, Dr. Martin Hess, who's played by Bill Murray, and Aaron is like really wants this guy to like them, and it's like he's seen as a... Yeah, and he's an authority figure, and of course he thinks they're absolutely full of crap. So we have the creepy Rowan dude show up outside of an Ozzy Osbourne show. He plants another one of the creepy metal devices. One of the people who works there comes across something, and so they call the Ghostbusters. And of course, Patty gets to be the one to meet the ghost at first. It's a creepy mannequin that's possessed by some sort of demon.
That goes about as well as her skit when she was in Saturday Night Live and she was in Ghostbusters.
She has a couple of great moments. Like, no! And so the proton packs, like, kind of zap out. So that's one of the things that's kind of different than the first movie, is that it's kind of a lasso, but not really. The proton packs act kind of like whips, and you can kind of, like, damage ghosts and slow them down with them.
Well, this thing is with a the proton huge, pack. Like, gargoyle.
Yeah, it's a gargoyle dragon green demon. That goes into the show above, and of course the crowd loves it because there's a band playing and they're like, and the sound guy is yelling, that's not mine.
They're like, yeah, I've just summoned a demon.
Yeah, and then the demon kind of turns around and grabs the guy and throws him into the back wall.
It's sitting on Patty's shoulders.
Yeah.
She's like, I'm just gonna go home. I'm just gonna turn around.
I'm gonna go back to MTA. It's a good job. I'm not gonna upset this ghost, which is on top of me right now.
Patty, don't move.
Yeah. And then Abby's like, yeah, don't hit her. Don't hit Patty anywhere important. And she's like, what? And then like, they zap him and trap him. And the entire city cheers. And the crowd goes absolutely nuts. They're super excited. Aaron sexually harasses Kevin again. And
it's just dancing.
And Martin Hess visits the Ghostbusters. And he's there because he calls them frauds to their face. And he's like, why are you doing this? And he basically is goading them as a big jerk.
See the ghost.
Yeah, and he's like, oh, it's very convenient that you say you have a ghost, but you're not going to open up this trap thing for me so I can see it. So Erin, desperately needing approval in all areas of her life, kind of the bridesmaid character again.
What does it feel like to wear a little bow tie that little?
Yeah, it came with a shirt. And Abby is like the one who's more like, you can come back later, you're just being a jerk. So everyone realizes he's being a jerk except for Erin, who's all huffy. And so she releases the demon, who promptly picks up Martin Hess and throws him out the second story window to his death.
That was so sad.
So the police,
no.
So the police show up and trying to figure out who killed Hess.
It was a demon.
And Homeland Security shows up quickly and whisks the Ghostbusters away to the mayor, who is played by Andy Garcia. His assistant is there too, who's played by Cecily Strong, who was originally up for one of the 4 original parts.
So
they explain together that they know the Ghostbusters aren't fraud, that a lot of these things that happen are real, but the public just, it's too much for them to understand, and so they just move on. They completely understand, thank him for their work, but you need to stop, and we're going to start totally discrediting you publicly. Again, Abby proves to be much more even-handed, and is basically like, we understand you're going to discredit us. We just want to keep doing the work. And so they're kind of reluctantly like, okay, but you gotta do it quietly. Holtzman shows them a new level of ghost busting gadgets, which are pretty cool, like a glove that you can use to punch ghosts and like some grenades and like a wood chipper for ghosts that sucks them in. And they start to realize where all these ghost sightings are. They're happening along these things which are called ley lines. It's basically this line where the space between our reality and the fantasy world is at its lowest. And sure enough, these ley lines intersect at the Mercado Hotel. They go to the website and they see that weird Rowan guy, and he's on the staff because there's a staff picture. The Ghostbusters gear up and they race down to the hotel where they meet a snarky hotel receptionist played by Annie Potts, being much more snarky than she was in the original Ghostbusters. So they race down to the basement, and sure enough, he has this massive machine which is going to rip through reality and bring in millions of ghosts into ours. And there's all these mirrors with the tons of ghosts trying to come in. And so Abby tries to talk him down, but the only thing she can think of worth saving in this world is soup. So that doesn't quite go well.
That's all I got.
However, surprisingly, Rowan doesn't turn the machine up all the way to break the barrier, but he grabs two of the huge main wires connecting to the machine and electrocutes himself to death. Everyone's kind of confused. Is it done? The mayor's assistant and police arrive, and they privately thank the girls and then say, oh, by the way, we're going to fake arrest you, but we towed your car, real tow, not fake tow. Before they leave, Abby and Aaron are also disturbed that as they're looking at the technology, they're like, wow, this technology is familiar to the technology that they wrote about in their book. And sure enough, Rowan has a copy of their book. So somewhat defeated, Aaron goes back to her apartment while the others go back to headquarters. And as Aaron is flipping through Rowan's copy of their book, she sees tons of notes. He lays out his plans to lead a army of ghosts to take over New York City and probably the world afterwards.
Apocalypse.
And in that step, like step three, is, by the way, commit suicide by grabbing both lines to the machine. She tries to contact the Ghostbusters, but Kevin, the receptionist, isn't at his post like he should be. And Abby is possessed by Rowan's ghost. And she steps out of the bathroom and starts destroying the machines. Jillian and Patty try to stop her. And we have what I think is my favorite moment, when Patty literally bitch slaps the ghost out of Abby. When she slapped out the ghost and then said, the power of Patty compels you, just completely cracked me up. Rowan is completely slapped out of Abby. He slapped out of the building and down to Kevin, who has created his own Ghostbuster uniform.
Motorcycle.
And he has a motorcycle.
He's going to help guys.
Because he's going to be just like them, because he's on the team. Rowan Kevin takes off of the hotel and overloads the machine, causing New York to be transformed into the glory days of New York City and be overrun by ghosts who wreak havoc on said city. Aaron tries to hail a cab. The driver is played by Dan Aykroyd, but he isn't going to Chinatown and he ain't afraid of no ghosts. So the other three Ghostbusters get the Ecto-1 stolen by Slimer. They're going to shoot the car to stop it, but Holtzman stops them because basically they have a nuclear reactor on top of the car, so if they miss, they're going to blow up a nuke in the city.
So it's like crossing the lines.
Yes, times 50. Rowan Kevin is confronted by a mishmash of police and firemen and National Guards, military, but he just simply freezes them. He then sends a host of ghosts after the Ghostbusters, and we have, honestly, I thought a really good fight scene. It was cool and slick, but in a way that would make sense that the girls could do it. They were good and they were effective, but it's like they clearly haven't been trained, yet the moves they were having the girls too, it was like, oh, that would make sense. And it would make sense that they would be able to perform them, that it would be too much for the ghosts. So I was really impressed by that fight choreography. So they fought through this huge wave of ghosts and they make their way to their Mercado Hotel. Once they open up the door to the Mercado Hotel, like, the machine has become the vortex, and it's based in the basement, but it's already kind of moved up into the lobby, like this huge big pool, and you see all these ghosts kind of coming out of it. And so Rowan Kevin confronts the girls and toys with them for a while, but
he's floating around like Peter Pan.
Yeah, but he's going to embrace it.
Is this too Peter Pan?
So after toying them for a while, he's tired of possessing Kevin. It's making him feel dumber by the second. And literally asks them, what form do you want me to take? Patty says something small and cute. So Rowan says, oh, something like this, and turns into the ghost from Ghostbusters, which I think by the fandom he's called Ghoulie, if I remember right. And then turns himself into Godzilla size. So the vortex keeps getting bigger and bigger. The girls realize that that vortex is the only chance they've got. So they were thinking, if we can explode the Ecto-1 in the center of the vortex, that will reverse the polarity or something.
It's got basically like a radioactive
something. It's whatever. It's your typical. I don't think it's real science, but we have to have a way to stop the vortex. So we'll just say that if we do a nuke in the middle of
there's
a tornado,
a nuclear reactor.
It'll just go the opposite way and suck everything in. So they do that, and they all hit it with a proton pack, and it explodes, and sure enough, it becomes this huge magnet, and it's sucking everything in except for the big Rowan ghost, who's kind of like holding on to buildings. And so the Ghostbusters shoot him between the legs to loosen his grip. So finally, the big Rowan ghost is also being sucked into this vortex, but not before he grabs Abby. And so she's also been pulled into this vortex.
It was so Ant-Man.
Yeah. So Aaron attaches a cable and hook to her belt immediately and dives into the vortex after her, catches up to the huge Rowan ghost and shoots him in the hand until he releases Amy.
Abby.
Until he releases Abby, Aaron says she wasn't going to leave her again. And they are perfectly timed, hoisted back up through the portal, which completely returning everything to the way it was.
That's what I actually am going to say right now. I preferred over original Ghostbusters is that everything got cleaned up at the end and I didn't have to have anxiety about the huge destruction mess that was left in the wake.
The mess took care of itself. Essentially, the movie ends with the girls getting the firehouse, the iconic Ghostbusters firehouse, to be their new headquarters. In the last cameo of the movie before the credits, Patty's uncle, which is played by Ernie Hudson, rolls up and wants to know what happened to the hearse that he lent her, which obviously got destroyed in a nuclear blast to save all of humanity. We also then have really impressive end credits sequence. And then we also have three or four post-credit scenes. Sigourney Weaver has a cameo as Holtzman's mentor. There's this mass dance number interspersed being led by the Rowan Kevin ghost. It evidently was the hardest thing for Paul Feig to cut, but they put into the end credits. The one Ghostbuster you might have noticed, I didn't mention, makes an appearance is Harold Ramis' character, Egon. And what happened is that Harold Ramis had died 2 years prior to this. He's in one of the very first scenes in the college. His bust is near Aaron.
Oh,
and that bust is now at the, I think it's Chicago, where there's a film institute. You know, named after Harold Ramis.
That's good, because I was waiting the whole movie for, like, a picture of him or, like, something.
Yeah, at the very end of the credits.
It was way too at the
They say for Harold Ramis.
Which, in my opinion, I think they should have done that the very first closing title.
Yeah.
At least they did it. I waited.
Yeah, I'm glad they did. And I'm glad they did both. But, yeah, what was good about it is that the special effects were spot on, or at least...
You can't compare them.
For our technology, oh, so much better.
But you can't compare them.
I know, kind of, but it was one of the things that I remember when I was young watching the original Ghostbusters. It was so cool. You were never allowed to say anything bad about Ghostbusters, but when it first came out, I was rolling my eyes at how bad. So I liked how the ghosts were actually scary. I liked the very opening at the mansion, and I liked how it was like, oh no, that ghost is dangerous. There's an actual stake to this movie. I know I'm going on and on about it, but I was super surprised and a huge fan of that fight scene at the end. They didn't run from the fact that the women were in their late 30s, early 40s. It was like, it was moves that made sense, but their technology was much better. And so anyway, it was really good. The script was uneven, but all four leads have moments. Like everyone has at least one or two scenes, which will make you laugh. Chris Hemsworth does steal the show. The other person who I thought stole every scene he was in was a super awkward delivery person for the Chinese restaurant, which I didn't get through because there was so much in this movie, but he has like four or five scenes and is hilarious in every single one of them. And that guy's name is Karen Sony, so I wanted to make sure I gave a shout out to him because he was awesome.
He's funny.
So when it comes to what was bad about it,
oh,
the film is a bit long.
I don't think it was long enough.
It feels even longer than its 2 hour runtime for me.
2 hours?
It's 2 hours. So the original cut was 4 hours and 15 minutes.
What?
So the script is long. The final cut is long for what it is. But like I said, I felt like the script was uneven. The biggest problems I felt with the script was the two main characters, Aaron and Abby. And I just didn't feel like they were defined enough. They had some funny jokes, but it really just kind of felt like Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy just riffing after a while. Like they kind of establish characters in the first couple scenes and they kind of forget those characters basically for the rest of the movie. Good dialogue is lines that should only be able to be said by that character. And I think in the beginning of the movie there were a lot of scenes where it was like, oh, that's a Patty line, oh, that's a Holtzman line, oh, that's an Abby line, oh, that's an Aaron line. And then at the end they were saying lines which just anybody could say. The other thing was that, I mean, I was kind of confused by it when it happened, but the climax of the movie clearly is Aaron diving into hell to risk her life and immortal soul to save Abby. And that line, I'll never leave you again, that should have been an oomph. But there was no doubt that she would try to save her at that point in the movie. They had a real problem at the beginning of the movie, and then they just had a little bits of bickering.
She had already decided that she was in all the way by that time.
There was just no tension. Maybe this was part of the 4-hour, 15-minute cut. Maybe you could have had that Aaron was petrified at ghosts. So her coming at the end to save the three, that could have made like that whole fight scene at the end even better. F that, I'm facing my fears because of my friends. You know, or you could have had Aaron just preoccupied with losing that Columbia position. They just kind of made it a throwaway. They could have made that the thing between her and Abby. And it's like, well, I'm doing this not because I want to, or this is my only chance to get back to Columbia. And that could have dovetailed really nicely with, we never get the scene with Abby where Aaron kind of takes off. It's like, we never got the scene of, you got too cool for school and you left me. Any of those three, especially if you folded in the last two, would make that line of Aaron saying, I will never let you go again, would have made that a much stronger climax, I felt like. I think that the four they cast were incredible. Mm-hmm. The guy who played Rowan, he does a really good job. I buy that he's creepy. But if he's going to be the big bad of the movie, there needed to be more oomph. I was watching the whole movie thinking like, gosh, Bobby Moynihan would have kicked that out of the park. Or like Jason Schwartzman or Patton Oswalt.
Patton Oswalt would have been awesome.
Yeah, and I will die on the hill that Bobby Moynihan should have been. I think he would have not only been great at it, but I think it would have propelled his star, because he kind of, we haven't seen as much of him recently. Do you want to know what I think as the final rating should be?
Yes. Please tell me.
To me, it is no doubt 2 thumbs up.
What? Even after you just went on and on about how I can't stand it.
It's not that I can't stand it. It was good. I think it has its problems. And I am absolutely not heartbroken that they didn't do a sequel, because I think of all franchises, Ghostbusters has proven how impossible it is to do a sequel to the original. But it's a good movie. It is really good. And it got way more crap than it deserved. Mm-hmm. And I'm really upset at a lot of the reviews I'd read about it, because does it live up to the original? No. But guess what?
But they're not trying to.
Well, not only that, the original guys couldn't live up to the original. They tried. I honestly think you can't be a real Ghostbusters fan without seeing this movie. I know there are people listening to this like, well, no. I mean, they could do a sequel. They did Ghostbusters Afterlife. It's like, yeah, they did. And it is a spectacular movie that I hope to make you watch in a future episode.
Did you watch it?
Yeah, I watched it.
Without me?
I watched it at 3x speed in Spanish. That's the only way to watch it for free, because you can't rent it or anything. And then I went and read the script afterwards. But Ghostbusters Afterlife is a totally different movie than the original Ghostbusters.
Well, it's a different tone.
As wonderful as Ghostbusters Afterlife.
And I didn't see it at 3x in Spanish.
Yeah. As good as that movie is, and yes, that's worthy of being a sequel, it is only a movie that could have been made now. If you had tried to make that movie even 5 years before, you would not have been able to make that movie. It kind of hits some cultural things that you just couldn't hit until we all got to this point. So, So yeah.
We weren't ready.
No. 2 thumbs up, though. Good job.
Wow.
Good job. And you definitely, if you hear the sound of my voice, if you're a fan of Ghostbusters, and that means basically everyone on the planet, you should see this movie. You need to see it. So there we go.
Mike, his name's Mike Hatt.
So his full name is Michael Hatt?
Michael Hatt. All right, well, we finally are getting this episode out of Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters.
Only took, I don't know.
A year.
It's our baby, so.
Our baby?
Yeah, it took a year to make it, so it's like.
Oh, yeah. We're an elephant baby. It's our elephant baby.
So what are we going to watch for next time?
I have always wanted you to watch Better Off Dead with me, because I love that movie. I haven't seen it in probably 15, 20 years, so it'll be interesting to see.
I'm just trying to count how many decades it's been since I've seen it. I was not impressed. It was one of my first video library rentals. So
that was like your first video rental?
One of them, yeah.
I still remember my first video rental.
Which was what?
Footloose.
Nice. And I figure, since you were trying to tell me that Better Off Dead was a Christmas movie.
It is. It takes place during Christmas.
I was also trying to think of a non-traditional Christmas movie. We already did Die Hard. So it was between Batman Returns and Gremlins. You gave me a look for Batman Returns. Your eyes rolled all the way back in your head when I said Gremlins. So that's what won.
Well, I've never seen Gremlins. I was not allowed.
Well, about to watch it.
Okay. Ralph Macchio?
I don't even remember who stars in it.
Is Pat Morita in it?
I don't know. We'll have to see.
What do you mean you don't photo.
Well, I saw it. The only time I saw it was in the theaters. Oh. So
this is another one offer.
This is a one offer.
And from it's 30 years ago.
Yeah, let's say 30.
Should be good.
Well, thank you so much for listening to us on He Saw, She Saw.
We have a Facebook page and we have an Instagram page. But please rate and review us so that we can climb those charts. We're like number 897 out of 898.
Woohoo! Going up, baby.
Do that, and we will talk at you
next time.